The Amat Project.
Hello everyone, good afternoon. It's really wonderful to have the opportunity to talk with you today. I'm going to give a very quick introduction to myself. It always seems when someone who's a contactee or an abductee or an experiencer, you always feel under pressure. Because if you're a whistleblower, you perhaps have a P45 or some documentation which showed where you worked. It doesn't mean what you said was true, but it means that you were in a likely position to see what you allege. Unfortunately, when you're an experiencer, you can't prove it. So you, the audience, if you don't have experience or you're not a researcher, you are asked to believe what you're told. Very difficult indeed. Okay, I'm actually a politician. I'm an elected Labour councillor in Whitby. Moved to Whitby in 1999 with my wife, and I was a very prominent local politician in Hackney, and I threw away the chance to be a Member of Parliament because I didn't like the area I lived in, the violence, the filth. It was just too much. So we moved, and having said I won't get back involved in politics, I eventually did, so I'm an elected politician. And that's very difficult for the powers that be in how they would deal with me, because as an elected official, it means I have positions of some responsibility, and I must be credible, otherwise I couldn't hold office. So for someone to stand here and tell you his reality does pose them with some problems. And later on during our talk together, I'll highlight some of the ways that they've hit back. Okay. I've entitled it Mantids, Reptiles and Hangers-On. The majority of the beings that I've encountered are mantid, reptilian, shadow beings, and the feline species, the lion and the cat people. I'll very briefly touch on the greys, but they've come up already. Okay. I'm going to divide this talk basically into three. Three is a very, very sacred number for the extraterrestrials. And so it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me. So part one will be looking at my human mother, and I'll explain why I call her that in a moment, my grandfather. Part two will look at my early days and the beings that I've experienced. And part three, in later life, and perhaps what it means for me personally, and maybe for a wider audience. Okay, I'm going to have 5 minutes at the end for questions because it's a small group, then I would like some interaction with you, if possible. Now then, Wynne Keach. Yeah. Wynne Keach, on three occasions, there's the magic number, Wynne, talked about a three-word agency. I didn't know you were going to do it, Wynne. I didn't remote view you. Do you know what that is? Anybody know what that building is without Wynne or anyone else who's a researcher? Nearly. The American version of it. Yes, yes, it's the NSA's headquarters, and you can see it looks like a shopping center or an airport. Look at the number of cars, thousands and thousands of employees. And the black glass building, two of those floors are absolutely covered in ducts, which cover super cooling liquid to keep the massive computers and a position where they don't explode. So two of those floors are absolutely dedicated, the whole length of that building, to supercomputers. Every email that is sent in the world is logged there. It doesn't mean they read every email, but it means that they have the ability to do that. There are billions of phone calls, emails, any form of information, that's where it's looked at. Okay. I won't ask if there's anybody from MI5 or MI6 or the NSA here today because you wouldn't identify yourselves, would you? For those of you who are new to this, you might be surprised to actually realize that it's a regular form of infiltration, right down to club level. They will attend clubs. Okay, here we go. Frequency of contact. I often get asked, how often do they visit you? A couple of people have spoken already saying that you don't always know when they come for you. Sometimes you remember immediately as it's taking place. Sometimes it may be an hour, a month. Sometimes you don't know. This is a little drawing I've done, and it's, oh no, not you again, what do you want this time? Often a grey will appear as an owl. I really don't like greys. I despise them. Sorry. Okay. My memories, like Chantal's, come back during the day. About 20% of my memories have been from the moment they occurred from childhood. And I've coped with that through adolescence and in my 20s, my 30s, by rationalising them away or pretending they didn't exist, blanking them out of my mind. And I managed to do quite well with that and coped quite well. As I approached my 50th birthday, a whole load of memories came back, usually sparked off by something on the radio, the television, or a bright colour or a sound. And what I'll do is I'll keep reams of paper and a pen, and I'll sit myself down, the memory will come back, and I will immediately draw it down very roughly, very, very quickly, before doing it in a little bit better. I'm no artist. What we've got here is on the bottom corner, dated the 26th of the 9th, 2010, is a very, very quick drawing that I would have done. I'm showing you how I do it. I cut it out in this case and stuck it, and there's the follow-up drawing. You can see, actually, the follow-up drawing isn't accurate. It just shows how it changes. In the original drawing, there's no legs. I'm assuming it did have legs. I don't remember them. So I popped the legs in. Also, the neck is a lot longer on this being. Can you see all that? Great. But other than that, it's fairly accurate. So that's how I've done it. I did it originally because I wanted to help myself to understand what was going on. Before Amash came on scene, there was absolutely no help apart from Dave Hodrin. In fact, Dave Hodrin, was it 2009, 2007?
2009.
So my experiences started just before then. And I went to an organization called Bufora. And they weren't very helpful at all. So I gave up on them because I spoke to a very, very nice lady who was the researcher and based in Newcastle, in the northeast. And she said to me, UFOs aren't real. It's all religious stuff. It's all supernatural. I don't believe in them. And I said, well, you're a researcher, supposed to be independent, yet you've already formed an opinion. So I didn't hear any more from her. I then thought about joining MUFON. And a lot of people said, well, you won't get on to MUFON because, therefore, the Americas only, which is true. I did actually contact MUFON, although someone said to me they were set up by an ex-director of the CIA. Frankly, I didn't care. I just wanted to contact other people who had experiences. So I emailed, and the next day I got an email back saying, look, I'm sorry, we have thousands of reports of colored lights, and we're not really interested. So I emailed back and said, are you interested in the beings that fly these craft? Within 7 minutes, I got an email back saying, can you describe them? To which I said, I can do better than that, I'll send you some drawings. So I scanned and emailed some drawings. 3.5 minutes later, an email came back from the director. MUFON's broken into different groups, but there's an overall director, saying, thank you very much indeed, I've got your drawings, we would like to accept you. Now, when you go onto David Hodrin's or any other site, you have a password, you go onto a web page, and then you enter and you can have a blog, you can chat away. And I said to him, oh, that's great. When will I be on? Oh, you're on. What do you mean I'm on? Oh, it's just kind of come through straight to your emails. I said, well, if it's coming through my emails, oh, no, he said, no, nobody else can read it. It's all encrypted with the highest security. So I could do what we do on a monthly basis with Dave Hodrin and his group, actually on my emails. So they had some pretty high-tech equipment to enter my, it was BT, it's not some cheap thing, enter it and set me all up in America by pressing a switch. I stayed there 3 months. I found them extremely helpful. They fell over backwards for me. They couldn't have done any more for me. They were really supportive. The managers of these groups were excellent towards me. I've got no problem with them. And I just left because I'd moved on. I was ready for something else. Personal confirmation. I believe what I know is true. I have no doubt. But, you know, I'm savvy enough to realize that I can't stand in front of a group of people and say, take my word for it. So I needed some personal proof myself. There's a guy called Phil Hoyle. I don't talk to him now. And he was a researcher, and he was very keen on getting badges or logos or emblems from either alien spacecraft or the entities themselves. This is a missing time period in June 2010. I won't touch on that's a crystal being in the side, but I'm going to talk about the 6 males and 1 female. There's the female. She's cute, isn't she? How do I know she's a female? I feel it. I feel it. She's also about that much shorter than the males, physically. On the right-hand side is the badge. I couldn't remember all of it. The lead grey here, and they're being very respectful to this creature because his resonance is so high. I don't think they can cope with it very easily. And he has a badge, and I did say, badge on chest, it's not complete. And I said, well, I've got that. Shall I send it to you? And he was very, very keen to see that. And from a family in Sunderland, husband, wife, 2 children, there was that. And what Phil Hoyle said is, you have seen this and this. I'm just going to go back to it now. I actually agree with him, believe it or not. The backward question mark and the wavy line. I don't think that's a badge saying who we belong to. I was just chatting to Wynne. I think that's more about that being's role or responsibility. And interestingly enough, it's only about 45, 50 miles from where I live. So that was interesting. But it gave me the confidence to know that somebody else had seen something that I had seen. All right, part one, my grandfather. My grandfather, an extremely unusual gentleman. I didn't know what the word Illuminati meant until 3 or 4 years ago. In 1979, when I was 20 or 21, my grandfather sat me down and banished his wife out of the room. And for 2 hours, he told me. And there's no record of him, unfortunately. So when he died, the vicar did a little sermon, and that's the original letter, and it's Reverend Colin Laverne. Days before computers were widespread, this is 1979, and I beg your pardon, 1993, is it? What's the date on it? Because he got the date wrong when during the actual eulogy. Okay, these were the notes that were made. My grandfather was a member of MI6. He was a prominent Mason. And he, in 1930, was given the OBE for some riot that he controlled in India. And it brought them to the attention of MI6, who recruited him. And this allowed him to travel all over the world. In 1936, Edward VIII had an affair with Wallace Simpson. My grandfather told me that whatever you've been told officially is not true. What my grandfather told me was that Wallace Simpson was not a full spy for the Nazis, but she was supportive. And she was having an affair with von Ribbentrop, who was the ambassador at the British Embassy at the time, and passing documents across to the Nazis. And it was interesting enough, the special branch who brought this to the attention of the British government. And they said, you can't have this man as a king because war is coming with Germany. We're rearming and you cannot have this man as king. He's got to go. And the Prime Minister vacillated, didn't know what to do, and one of his aides suggested, why don't you form a jury of 12 good men and true, all men in those days, I'm afraid, 12 good men and true, and they can decide whether the king stays or goes. My grandfather was one of those 12. He was actually based in India. He received, I think a telegram or something like that, but it was in code, and he said to me, you had to keep your messages really short, because they could so easily be broken. And the message said, should the king stay or go? And I said, well, grandfather, what did you reply? And he said, go. I said, what was the votes? 10 voted for him to go, 2 voted for him to stay. And the king asked the prime minister whether he could go address the nation on the BBC. And he was told, no, you can't do that. You can't marry her. You're going to go. And if you don't abdicate, we will remove you through Parliament. He had no choice but to go. And back then, in those days, I just thought, wow, that's my grandfather. Wow. Now, of course, I realised that you don't have that sort of power unless you are an Illuminati. You just don't. And the joke is, I mean, he hated politicians. My grandfather, if he knew I was a politician now, he would absolutely be furious. So here is a non-elected official making a decision on another non-elected official who, whether he should stay or go. And you're the people that vote. And you have no say in it. And that's the reality. That was 1936. Okay, so my grandfather was a prominent Mason. He had to buy himself out because a journalist was sniffing very close to him in terms of his work with the government. My grandfather was given the MBE for work he did. He was given the CBE, that's the Commander of the British Empire. He was offered a knighthood, which he turned down. He had a falling out with the powers that be because he objected to something a Conservative Prime Minister was doing. And it was suggested that he leave his job and go and work for the United Nations, which he did. So in the 1950s, he went for the United Nations. And this note here, we've got the word appointment. 1930s, handling of riot, awarded OBE an appointment, because the family never mentioned MI6. You did not mention it. It was always known as the appointment. You did not talk about it. And in 1951, he was on the United Nations, representing the British government. And then he came to Britain and he was given a golden handshake, and Wynne will be interested. He was asked what stocks and shares would he like, and he said Rolls Royce, and they said the motor car, and he said no, if it's got no future, the engine. So he got a huge number of stocks and shares in Rolls Royce engines. He went to Mappin and Webb's in Regent Street, one of the most expensive jewellers, and chose a beautiful solid silver tea hot coffee service. And he was told, you're not going to get a pension because we do not want you tied to the British government. So you're going to live off the income from your stocks and shares. That was my grandfather. So, King Edward VIII, Stalin. In 1949, he was dispatched to Stalin to find out what happened at Roswell. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Because the Winston Churchill, who was a member of the Illuminati, had lost the general election, 1945, which absolutely shocked the Americans. And what was he replaced with? Not just somebody who wasn't a member of the Illuminati, but a socialist. So a lot of ties with Britain were cancelled. When the Roswell incident occurred, the Americans were not sharing much. So my grandfather was dispatched to Stalin because they knew that Stalin would have the info on this. What my grandfather told me was that Stalin said, give me 10 years and I will have infiltrated the CIA. Which is about right. Give me 10 years and I will know what the CIA are doing. He refused to tell my grandfather anything about alien technology. As my grandfather left, he said, I'll give you a present. The nearest thing to alien technology we have is a mineral called alexandrite. And he gave my grandfather a beautiful, beautiful bracelet for a woman in 18 karat gold with his beautiful gems set in it. And he said, this mineral, when under daylight, I think it glows blue, but when you put it under artificial light, it turns green. And Stalin said to my grandfather, that is the nearest to alien technology we've got. Give it to your mistress. My grandfather, being a very solid gentleman, said, I don't have a mistress. I'll give it to my wife. And grandfather said, where's it come from? And he said, well, just before we murdered the Tsarina and the Tsar, we took all her jewelry off her. And that's one of the Tsarina's jewelry. So my grandfather for you. JFK, my grandfather told me that they hated JFK anyway. They hated JFK and the CIA. They hated JFK because they couldn't control him, and the alien agenda was the last straw. So he wasn't killed, he was murdered. He wasn't killed just because he was going to ask questions regarding the alien agenda. He was killed because they just had enough of him. The American military wanted JFK out, and they would go to no ends to remove him. And that was the very last president who stood up on his own two feet, because after that, every president knew if you buck the trend, that's the route you go down. So they made the signal and they got what they wanted. Grandfather actually built a school for girls in Cheshire as a Mason, privately funded. And he fell out with the British government, but he got the golden handshake and he worked at the United Nations. Okay. He had two children, son and a daughter, my mother. The newspapers, some of the newspapers have had a great fun about Simon Parkes' Mother is an Alien. That's not quite right. This creature did not give birth to me. It's a term used. And I've actually did some real trawling around on the internet. It's very hard to find. But there's a guy who'd collated a number of children's reports regarding the mantid or mantis beings. I highlighted some of them. They're referred to as the Great Mother. In 1990, a hypnosis session with a young girl called Cindy Tyndall, she described an abduction by a bug wearing a wig that makes her think, it's my mum, but it's not my mum. David in Carla Turner's Into the Fringe, 1992, sees a mantis, and Carla suddenly has memories of looking at a giant grasshopper and insisting, you're not my mother, you're not my mother. In a different letter, a child tells how she was taken up to a life raft, that's how she described it, floating in the air and saw what she thought was her grandmother. But as she said, I'm afraid it was just a great big bug. Okay, so for every 10 children that the mantis approach, pretending to be relatives, 9 children are clever enough to see through it and say, no, you're not related to me. Unfortunately, or fortunately, either I didn't see through it, or I chose not to see through it, or I recognized something in this being that I connected with. So I refer to this creature as mum. Now, as I grew up, this was very difficult when I'm sort of 3 and 4 years old, because I told people I had 2 mothers. And I used to, the very first word, apparently, my human mother said, the very first word I said was daddy, and I used to call my human mother daddy. And the reason for that was, well, I have a mother. So you can't be my mother, you must be my daddy. And I realized as I got older, it's socially unacceptable to do that. You can't say you've got 2 mothers, you have to shut your mouth and play the human game. But it didn't stop these creatures coming to me. Okay, my mother. She worked at a patent office called G.F. Redfern & Co., which was in Brighton, East Sussex, on the London Road. And there was a guy there who was a freelancer called Paul Dunlop. And Paul Dunlop would pop in and out of the office from time to time. And one day, Paul Dunlop and a gentleman all dressed in black with a white shirt and a black tie turned up, rang the doorbell. I opened the door and Paul said, is your mother in? Yes, she is. So I called for my mother and she came through and Paul said, oh, Jean, this gentleman wants to ask you a few questions. And the gentleman took out a folded reef of papers, not very big, and then said to my mother, sign these. So my mother, single parent, quite rightly said, well, what are they? Well, I'm not telling you, just sign them. No, I'm not signing something that I don't know. This argument went back and forth, and in the end, my mother said, well, I'm going to call the police. This gentleman then sat on the sofa and said, good, they'll make you sign it. And at that point, she realized that this was extremely serious. And Paul said, oh, for God's sake, Jean, just sign the papers. Do you love your country? So she said, well, of course I do. Do you want to earn 2 wages? 2 wages? Yeah, you sign these papers and I will pay you every month, but and you'll still get your wages from GF Redfern. But you don't have to work there. You just go down 3:30 every Friday. They're going to give you the money. Now, you're a single parent. You know, didn't use those terms in those days. 2 wages would be really handy, wouldn't they? So my mum signed it. Whereupon the man said, you have just signed the Official Secrets Act. You have been cleared to an extremely high level. If you talk about today or any of the work you do with us, you will be found on a railway line. Then who will look after your son? With that, straight out the door. So mother turned on Paul Dunlop. Is this a joke? No, no, this is not a joke. He admitted that Paul Dunlop was not his real name. He spoke 7 or 8 languages. A hugely gifted man. He had his own private aeroplane. He had a Formula 2 racing car. He had 3 or 4 MG cars. And as he said, I took my name off a tyre. I took my name off a tyre. His own words. My mother's job was to type out documents relating to crashed UFO craft. We're talking now from 1971 to 1979. Paul would turn up with documents in German. Wynne Keats has talked about Operation Paperclip, where the Americans in particular, the British to a lesser extent, brought over as many Nazi scientists as they could, absolved them from their crimes of murdering people, and allowed them to earn nice big wages and to staff the big corporations that are running the world today. And these documents were never white, they were cream-coloured paper, they were all in German, they had the German eagle on the top. No, they did not have the swastika on, that's always a question that radio interviewers ask me. No swastikas at all, West German Republic. And in the top right-hand corner would be in red ink, secret, top secret, very top secret, and the special group, the purple group in purple, extremely top secret. And whenever we had an extremely top secret document, we would have what was then the GPO, British Telecom now, van parked 24 hours a day outside the house. And what happened was that my mother had the documents, Paul Dunlop had translated from German into English on a spool of tape. She operated what's called a dictaphone, very old-fashioned. You pressed a pedal, a sentence came out in English, and she typed it. She worked at home, and Saturdays and Sundays I wasn't at school, and at lunchtime she would leave the document out, go into the kitchen, make her food, make my food, come out, give me my food, she'd go back to the kitchen, and all the years we never ate together, she would never eat with me. I know people find this very difficult. I did not have a normal upbringing. Okay, that's just, I just don't do the human stuff. And so I would go and read these documents for an hour. And I would hear her feet coming back up the hall. I'd just walk away for 5 or 6 years. That's what I did. And I read these documents. They were relating to not just crashed craft, but the technologies that were inside them. So they would get a brief. What is this? What can you do with it? And what time scale for the applications? And there would be blueprints, drawings. Some of the documents might just be 3 pages. Some might be 10, 15 pages thick. And it was power plants, a fantastic amount on the miniaturization of computers, energy weapons, time travel. It never said how the aircraft, the UFOs were brought down. It never said where they were crashed. It was just presenting with these are the questions. And it was a very scientific paper. Most of it went over my head, but a lot of it didn't. When Paul Dunlop arrived, he would discuss this with my mother, and researchers have said to me, it's very odd that you were never asked to leave the room. And I would, as a small boy or a young boy, be playing with, I don't know, my toys, my scalectrics or whatever I had, and they would be discussing Roswell. They didn't call it Roswell. It wasn't called Roswell. Well, they didn't call it Roswell. And they would talk about weapons, Nazi scientists, and every time I would look round at them because they might say something interesting, he would smile at me. He would actually look at me and smile. And when Mother would go and make the coffee, he was an RAF pilot. He used to fly Lightnings. He called them the Frightening. And he would play, and he would be the pilot, and he'd want me to be the co-pilot, and we'd get some chairs. And then we would go chase the UFO, and he would say, jinx left, fire missiles, and that's how we would play. And now I look back on it, and I think, my God, that's really odd. That here's a guy steeped in the highest levels of security relating to me in this way. But at the time, he was just a kind guy who, I didn't have a father, remember, who was being nice to me. So we lived in a constant state of security alert. Mother would walk to work once a week to get her wages. A guy would walk to the park and he would tell her what day, what time she had to take these documents that she'd typed. She'd get in a green Jaguar, give a password to the guy in the passenger seat. They would drive to Brighton Station. She would get out, walk to the London-bound platform. It was cost 2p in those days to get a platform ticket. And she would have a copy of the Financial Times with a document that she typed in it. She'd sit on the first bench by the beginning of the platform. It's like James Bond. A guy, bowler hat, red carnation, briefcase, umbrella, copy the Financial Times under his arm and come and sit next to her. And they would have some inane conversation in code, such as, I think it's raining in Littlehampton. Yes, I know, but the train there is a stopping train. She would put her paper down, he would pick it up with a document, then he would put his paper down, he'd go on the train to London, she'd go back home. These names of these people, I'm not going to give them, but their ranks, the lowest rank was captain, and the highest rank was a full colonel. So they were all military people. And she was told that you work for MI5, well, you don't really, you work for the NSA, but we're managing you. So my mother worked for the NSA. Of America. She wanted out. She became an alcoholic. She could not cope with what she was reading. It just blew her mind. She just couldn't cope, and she couldn't talk to anyone. She was very loyal to this country. She didn't discuss it with anyone, nobody. And she was a wreck, and she went to her handler, and she said, I can't do this anymore. I want out. You promised me you'd give me my old job back. And they did. They gave her a job back. She went back to work at GF Redfern, and then 2 weeks later, she died. And I'm honest. I ran away from the situation. I couldn't cope with it. So after a year or so, I thought, I've sod this. I'm going to go to London. So a bit like Dick Whittington, really. Run away from it. I had no father, no mother, the only child. And that was it. The day before I left, I got an envelope pushed through the door with £2,000 in it, which was a lot back in 1979, I can tell you, in very used notes. And a little tight note which said, "Don't look back, Dick Whittington." So that's my sorry money for what they did to her, because they killed her. They had no choice. She was loose cannon to them. She knew stuff that could have blown the whole operation. So I understand why they did it. It doesn't mean I agree with it, but I understand that their protocol would have required that immediately. Okay, that's enough of that. My first memories. These are the memories that I remember. The very first one I've got, that. I must be 3 months old and two hands reaching down into my cot to lift me up. And all I can remember is that's not my mummy's hands. Five, should be five. There's four there and there's no thumb and they're green and pointy. Second one. So it lifts me up. I've got no memory of the body at all. And it lifts me straight up, and I've put the sensation of being lifted up and strange hands around my middle. But it didn't hurt. And I look into this being's eyes, and I don't think this being makes a contact necessarily telepathically. I think it goes through the optic nerve. I think they connect direct to the optic nerve. Your eyes join straight to your brain. And it just said, "I'm related to you. I won't hurt you." And then all I remember is like falling down a well. Everything went black and I was just, if you can imagine, falling backwards over a well. And that was all I remembered. Education. I can remember probably 8 months, 9 months old. I can sit up and look above my head and I see lots of toys spinning. Soldiers, trains, building blocks. And as I look, they change into beautiful, beautiful sharp shards, like you took a plate glass window and you smashed it, and then you coloured each piece of glass a bright colour, and then you tried to push them all together, but don't let them touch, just push them together, and then holographically turn that into a ball and float that round your head. Three creatures, they're not exactly greys, they've got great bulges at the back of their heads, and their eyes have these strange lids. And this one on the right, I'm number two, he telepathically says to me, "Look, feel, understand." And when they walk, and I've put this one here, walks like a robotic snake-like way. Very weird way of walking. And again, I'm probably not even one. Shadows. We've had some talk about the shadows. 1963, I'm 3.5 years old. And this thing walked straight through the wall. I don't know where my human mother is. And I think this is the first time I've seen them, and I'm absolutely terrified. Scream and scream and scream, and I run and I hide behind the sofa and I go into the fetal position. And all my life, I had to lie about this in my mind. And I said, "I'll tell you what's happened." Oh, I'm sorry, I should have said that what happens is that this thing changes into a clown. That doesn't work. And it changes into a policeman. That doesn't work. Trying to reassure me. And when he changed into a clown, I got an image of a big top. Lots of children, and all children laughing. But these ETs don't get the connection that's funny, but a thing that walks through the wall doesn't work. And I could sense, somehow I was linked to this creature, I could sense that it was confused. It didn't understand why it was reacting. The policeman then was designed to calm me down and be safe, because back in 1963, I think policemen were perhaps a little bit closer to the community than they are now. So what I thought was, I tell you what's happened, you know. Mum's gone out for some cigarettes. I've got left alone, wondering where my mum is. I start screaming. The next door neighbour calls a policeman, the policeman breaks the door in, the policeman comes in and rescues me. I'm happy with that. It didn't explain how it walked through the wall, it didn't explain how it turned into a clown, but that didn't matter. I had to live this life on this planet. And these are the ways I coped. If I couldn't form some sort of twisted story to make it sound real, I would just push it out the back of my mind and I wouldn't even consider it. This is the second shadow. Okay, on the left-hand side, this is the same interaction. On the left-hand side, I see him floating outside the window. And I open my arms out like this. This is the part of the first key lock of the signal that I recognize who he is. He's not very good. He can't do it. He can just do that. But that's good enough. That means that we see each other. He then floats through the window. The window doesn't smash. There's no wobble of the nothing. Just comes straight through it, glides in, lands in front of me. And then he holds his hands upright like this. I do the same. Now, things come back to people. And after about a year after doing this drawing, I remembered that what happens was that an electric charge goes across from one of his arms to the other. And then he throws it to me and I catch it. And this is, in human terms, think of a tumbler lock. This is a genetic tumbler lock. Nobody else can interact with me. No one else can interact with him on that. That's a special lock that releases our abilities to communicate and work together. They didn't want anybody else coming to me. So this is a most advanced locking system. Okay. Normally, I don't see eyes. This is the first and only time that I ever saw eyes. And they were just like, just discernible. And I never called him a shadow being. That's what you researchers call him. To me, he was always my smoke man because he appeared to have this smoke that came off his body. But it never went up to the ceiling. It would just come up here and never dissipate. It was just continually growing off him. It was the most incredible experience. This being taught me some very interesting stuff. And sadly, while I was at school, my academic studies went right down the toilet to the extent that I had a psychologist, I had special teachers to help me with my English and my maths. I had a teacher come on a Sunday to the house. For the 3 or 4 months that this being was interacting, my traditional skills were right down. But when he'd finished interacting, my reading age of 7 became 12. So it had been a huge pendulum swing back and had advanced ahead. We don't have time to talk about what we did together. Not today. Okay, 1971. This is one of the most important points for me because I made an agreement with the Mantid race, a soul agreement. Most people who have experiences have made an agreement. Unfortunately, you don't remember them. And it's so disempowering when you get taken and you don't know why they take you. And it's a very difficult situation. This is a spacecraft. It's silver, no windows, no sound, traveling very slowly. I call for my friends, Sharon Lendrum, Tammy Lendrum, Adrian Atkins, Chloe Atkins, and Melissa Atkins from the two doors down. And we went over to the park and we saw that for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then as soon as it disappeared over the horizon, I saw a very lovely old red biplane with 3 huge cameras attached on struts to it. And I remember it coming over. I don't ever remember it going over the top of my head, and I don't ever remember it going after the UFO. I didn't hear a voice, but the feeling I got was, don't worry, we know they're here. We're filming them. Keep this secret. And we all walked back. We didn't play in the park, which was odd. And we walked back and I said to the girls, oh, what do you think that was? Oh, it's a shooting star. I said, what about the red aeroplane? What red aeroplane? You know, the biplane, the one with the pilot. And didn't see that. Oh, what about the school that's up there? What school? The school that's up there. There's no school up there. So I realized there was something very odd going on. 2010... that memory came back to me in 2 or 3 chunks. Again, we don't have the time to go into all of it. I'm just going to quickly go through it. Literally, if you put an industrial vacuum cleaner on your chest, that's how it felt. I was on the ground and it was like a huge sucking sensation and I was floated or pulled upwards. I don't remember passing through the wall of the ship. I've got no memory of that. But inside was a school. Now, I've been in contact with Mary Rodwell. She was very interested because she's been talking to young children about their experiences in this school. But she calls it the school in space. I just called it the school in the air because I didn't think it was in space. I thought it was just a few feet up there. And this is the actual layout here. This is what you researchers would call a Nordic. He's the school teacher. These are human females, sort of teaching assistants. And this is the young group. They've just been taken from the earth. They're 5 or 6 years old. They're using pens and paper because they're transitional stage pupils. Once they pass the tests, they go here and they have these discs they wear around their neck on a cord, and it's called a personal educator device, a PED. And I asked this young girl, what does it do? And she said, it teaches us. And I said, what does it teach you? And she was perplexed and said, everything. She is the pupil with responsibility. I asked her, what's your name? I am the pupil with responsibility. Yes, but what's your name? I am the pupil with responsibility. That was her name. And she would work with the kids through the groups. And she said, yeah, but you're not coming to school here. You're going up. And I'm only going to wait with you until he comes for you. Okay. This is it. When I saw this being, I was quite upset. I felt a connection to it, but I didn't really know what it was. It came straight up to me. I know you can all read, but it's very important to me, so I'm just going to read it out. He puts his two hands on my shoulders. They're very tall. And he says, would you like to be like us? To have knowledge and understanding, to see the future and know the past, to have power and. And at that point, I'm so excited about knowing about the past that I just communicate, yes, because I really do want to know about the past. I'm fascinated by it. And then he immediately says, then come with me. Now, I interrupted him. It doesn't matter where I interrupted him on his communication. Whatever he didn't say is mine. That's the contract. So the finishing word there is authority. To have power and authority. That was the end of the contract. But I didn't even need to get to the end of the contract. That's what I wanted. And so I made a bargain with them, which I still stick with. Okay, this was the same day, I think. I actually probably was there for 2 days because I had to sleep and I was given a metal bed to sleep on. And I was taken up a huge tower. This is under the earth somewhere. I don't know whether it's under the sea or under the earth. It's a huge cavernous place. And there were just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. There's about to be little faces, hundreds of beings. And he stands there and he holds my arm. And he lifts me up, almost so I'm on tiptoe. And I say, look at all those creatures down there. And these are all hybrids. And he says to me, they're your people. They are your people. Show your people that you love them. And on saying that, he lifts my arm up, and I'm actually on tiptoe. I've been up and down this pole more times than a fireman. Okay. On the second day, I was taken to what appeared to be a bit like a control room with a large chair, which I can only describe as like a dentist's chair, but much larger, and these plush seats that go around the side. I am not convinced that that's a window looking out on the earth. I think it's more likely to be a viewing screen putting up the earth, but it gives the impression of a spaceship looking over the earth, but we mustn't always believe what we're shown. And then the chairs are taken up by two tall greys and two small greys. I haven't bothered you with the way that the command structure on this craft is, but the two tall greys are principal operators. That's the POPs, the principal operator positions. The two little ones are secondary operator positions, so they're ranked in what they do. The reptilian, he's the keeper of the room. They love jobs like that. They're very proud. If you had a toilet and you said to a reptilian, stand and guard this toilet, he would be so proud 24 hours a day, he would stand there like that. Doesn't matter it's a toilet, it's a job. And it's a very important job. And he's so pleased to show me around the room. Reptilians don't have emotions as humans have. They have feelings, if I can, some sort of feelings, but they don't have emotions. And he'd been taught to smile for me. Because these creatures can be hideous to humans, if you're not used to them. And he had been taught to smile. And it was just a leering grin. And it was done to try to put me at my ease. Five humans in the corner, four men, one woman, all in white coats. The lead guy's even got a big biro in the top of his pocket. So I'm absolutely convinced that the government works hand in hand with these creatures. And their machines are ancient. I can smell them. They're so hot. These bloody great big machines are like furniture, like chest of drawers. And they're hot, and you can hear a fan going. And there are cables coming out of them. And look to the left, with all the superb high-tech equipment. No cables, no switches, nothing. Totally different. And some reason, these humans were involved because I was there. And to this day, I don't know what their job was. Mary Rodwell is working with a young boy in Australia who's about 8 years old. And he has mantid experiences. And he reported that he'd been lifted up in the air in a happy way and heard strange noises. And Mary said to me, "Have you ever heard anything of that?" And I said, "Oh, yes, that's what they do when they're very pleased with you." And I passed the test. These were all a series of tests. I passed the test, they lift you up, and they make a high-pitched chirruping sound when they're very, very pleased. I've never been to Australia, and yet here's a boy 2,500 miles away, whatever it is, who has had exactly the same experiences as me. And he says his soul isn't human. He's a mantid soul. And he's 8 years old and he's convinced of that. Okay, we're going to move on to the reptilians. Trauma in my life, visits and memories activated. The reptilians have visited me when I was little, very little. I don't remember it. Then they came back when I was in primary school and it brought it all back. Now, on the left-hand side, that's me in my first year at school. And on the right is 1 year later. That's when the reptilians came and said hello. And I said to my mother, "I don't want my hair like that. I want my hair different. I want to be a different person." I was always called alien at school because of my eyes. My eyes are very, very almondy-like. And this is the change. And Chantal was, you know, extremely brave. And she talked about how she'd lost weight. The reptilians are a very, very difficult race to manage. Very difficult race to manage. I call that mantid mum, and I was told to call a reptilian dad. White, red eyes. Originally when I drew him, I drew very big wings because that's in my mind what was so prevalent. But that's not accurate. I want to be accurate. They're more like spines. These can't fly with these wings. These things, they can flap them and move them. They signal with them during rituals and ceremonies, but they can't do much else with them. Nobody ever asked me about their genitals. Everyone's too embarrassed to ask about genitals. They keep them behind a flap of skin. Okay? And a very, very sour reply, "Are you happy? I am pleased." That's about the most you'll get out of them. Okay, I honour the culture. I really do. But I don't agree to this part of it. Difficult subject. I understand lots of people will take issue and won't agree with it, but this is my truth. Here I am as a small boy. The reptile on the left is my attendant. That's the easiest way that word would translate into English. It's a combination of a nursemaid, a butler, and a bodyguard all rolled into one. This creature doesn't love me. It has no feelings like that, but its job is to protect me and to look after me. And he says, "Shine bright, O bright one." They're always saying, "Shine bright, O bright one." And I'm either shown an image or I have actually been, and that's what I don't really want to think about. I've actually perhaps been in one of these ceremonies where they eat a young girl and we feast on sacrificial flesh. And on the right, the creature who wants me to call him dad says, "This is your world, your place in this world. This is your heritage and culture. What resides within also resides without." And that means what lives inside the earth is also genetically printed outside the Earth. That's a reptilian DNA. This is who you are, who you were, and who you will be. Shine bright, O bright one. I reject that. And I honour the culture, but I'm not going to have any part of that. Reptilians, a militaristic way of life. It's going to be quite new to you, some of this. When you think of armies, you think of thousands of men or hundreds of thousands of men. Indeed, the Russians in the Second World War had something like 6 million men on the field. The reptilians do not need anything like that. And that's why experiences never really report weapons, because they don't need weapons to control humans. Their minds are so evolved they can do that. And anyway, reptilians are 5, 6, 7 times stronger than the average man. So their armies can be quite small. They are phenomenal fighters. They're taking a bit of a pasting at the moment, but that's because so many different groups have aligned against them. So very, very briefly, one unit consists of 111 officers. When I say an officer, don't think of it in human terms. Think of it as a reptilian who has extra responsibilities. So there are 112 in a unit. You brigade 6 units together, you get that magic number of 666. But when you have the commanders together, it's 672. It's normal to brigade units together. So you can brigade 6 units together for 4,032 and so on. These are the standards. They do not go into battle with these standards. These are purely kept for sacred rituals. White is the sacred color. So the guy in the middle, I'm going to call him a guy, why not? The guy in the middle is the keeper of the sacred standard. And I'm sorry, it is SS, the sacred standard. He has a white sash across his, because white is the only colour that they honour, a white sash across, and the king and queen represented on top of a pole, the original king and queen. On the right hand side is a standard that would be used for a parent unit, so you've brigaded 6 small units together into a parent unit and you have that. It's normal to award valour when a unit is good in battle or delivers its target. It can be given teeth. It can be given claws, and if it doesn't fulfill its target, those teeth can be taken out. And you do not understand the dishonor if your standard has a tooth taken away from it. You cannot understand, unless you've researched them or you've experienced reptiles, the huge overarching dedication to ceremony and ritual. It is absolutely their way of life. And if you're really lucky, you get rubies in your dragon's eye to show how brave you've been. Okay. When I was very little, maybe 8 or 9 years old, I can remember standing in a gymnasium and the 6 or 7 of us boys in a line, 2 humans in tracksuits with whistles, so it's like a gym, and one of them says, "Want you to march like the reptilians. We know you can't do it, copy me." And he marches up and down and he says, "You've got to copy that." And on the ground there are white lines like a running track, and where each boy is standing, and you follow the white line, there's a line at the end where you stop. And he comes around behind us and touches our shoulders and says, "Boy 1, boy 2, boy 3, so we're all numbered. And then he blows his whistle, "Boy 1, off you go." So boy 1 tries to copy what he's just seen. Gets to the end of the line, the guy blows his whistle and says, "Boy 2. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, this is rubbish. They just can't do it. That's not how they walk. That's stupid. I'm going to do it my way. So when it comes to me and he blows the whistle, I do what I think is right. I get a quarter of the way down the line and the whistle goes and I think, "Oh, right, I've obviously got myself in trouble here." He then comes over to me and he does not hold my hand. He actually puts his hand on the back of my back and pushes me like this, "Come with me." That's what he's doing, like this. "Come with me, come with me." He takes me over to the corner and there are 2 reptilians standing in the corner. These ones are grey black, no wings, about 7 foot or so tall, and one of them says, "Lead your army." And behind him are a group of 6 or 7 reptilians, and I stand on the corner, and I just in my mind say, "Follow me." And I march. This isn't this drawing, this comes afterwards. And then these 6 follow me, and then the reptilian in my mind says, "Tell them to stop." Not halt, just tell them to stop, and I say, "Stop." On doing that, the guy who was the gym guy, the PE instructor, comes not running, because you can't run. If you run in front of a reptilian, it will think you're going to attack it and it will kill you. So he sort of walking very quickly, he comes over to me and he says, "Well done, well done, well done. You've brought honour on me, you've brought honour on us, and you've brought honour on yourself." Now, I don't see it so much now, but he put his hand on my head and roughed my head up, you know, like, shh, good boy. Shh. The reptilian leans across, takes his arm at the wrist, lifts him straight up, and he's literally off the floor and says, ours, not yours, and puts the guy down. Okay, and then he puts his hand on my head and leads me away, and I don't have any more memory of that. This is a separate memory where I was collected and I saw a procession. This guy in the middle, he has what we would call a face full of thunder. You'll see about that in a minute. Each job, they have to project a certain feeling. So this guy at the front, who's a family member, he projects a certain face. This one projects a face, and the others project. So you have to project both mentally and physically a set way of your authority. Okay. So this is the commander of the new unit. He's a family member. Only family members can command. He has the correct facial expression, a face like thunder. The guy with the double standard has the serious face, and the one at the back has a face full of pride and honor. And the ones that the rank and file also projecting pride and honor. Look at the way I'm standing. That's me. Very much to attention. The senior reptile has two children, a junior son, and a senior son, and they're both generals. This one's in line for the kingship once he hands it over. I know this is really hard for you to understand, those of you who have not seen this level and depth of interaction. Okay, 1965, I don't know how I'm doing for time. 1965, where my mother worked, one of her friends said she's getting married, and would I be a page boy at the wedding? And she said, well, I'll ask him. And I was chatting to another experiencer saying that may seem odd, but she didn't make decisions for me. She had to ask me. And I said, no, I'm not doing that. So they were very upset, the family. They came to the house and we struck a deal. I struck a deal with them. And if I did this, I would get a weekend in Butlins holiday camp. I could have any clothes for the wedding I wanted. But the reason that I wanted to do it was I suddenly felt this was good, because I was going to walk behind the bride holding her train, and behind me would be two bridesmaids, and to the right of me and the left of me would be audience. And it was a ceremony, it was a ritual, and I knew this is what I wanted. So again, this is going to be very difficult for you. It was a 5-year-old boy, and they said, what did I want to dress? I said, I wanted to dress like Hitler. Hitler, how does Hitler dress? And I said, and I didn't know the word for Lederhosen, but I drew it, short trousers, black stripe, and I said, I want my hair that way as well, like Hitler. So we had a compromise on the hair, but we got the clothes. Back in those days, you always did a dry run for your weddings. You don't do it now, it's conveyor belt, isn't it? But back then, even the photographer turned up with no film in his camera, and they did a rehearsal, and the vicar said to me, don't stand so formally, because I'm standing like that. Don't stand so formally. And I said, this is how you should stand during the ceremony. Copy me. Copy me. And the best man turned to the father of the bride and said, ha ha ha, Simon says. And then the photographer saying, smile, little boy, smile, for the pictures, the pretend pictures. And I said, it is wrong to smile during the ritual. And he turned to my human mother and said, well, can't you make him smile? And she said, if he chooses not to smile, I cannot make him. A face full of thunder. I'm standing at attention. I've got Hitler's clothes on, right? And the bridesmaids are dreadfully embarrassed because they've asked me to smile, and I outrank them. In my mind, I outrank them. They walk behind me. They can't be more important than me because they're behind me. And this is the reptilian culture, okay? When Win Keach first met me, he said to me, you have been around these beings for so long, you have taken on their personality. And then another time he said to me, you have risen up through their ranks. And then on another occasion he said to me, they trust you. They really trust you. So here I am, obviously traumatized by what the reptilians did. Let's not get away from that. But I'm playing the role, because that's what I had to do when I was with them in their world. Face full of thunder. There's the face. Look at the mouth. Look at the mouth dipping down. I've even got the facial expressions. Okay, so that's the way they are. Okay, then the bride asks me to smile. She outranks me. I was behind her. She must be more important than me. So I try a half smile. I don't know how to smile. I couldn't smile. These beings don't smile. Humans smile, but, you know, I'm not connected with humanity. I only connected with them, so I don't know how to smile. So anyway, great relief if I only got the page boy to smile, although it's a bit of a half part. Now then, this is the Butlin's holiday camp. My mum, human mum, came up to me and said, smile. So what I've done is a reptilian grin. Okay, if you have an awful lot of reptilian genetics in you, or your soul is reptilian, and Arnold Schwarzenegger is the great exponent of that, you will smile like that. If there's a female, a human female, or largely human female, who has a lot of alien reptilian genetics, that is quite sexy. Okay, that's how they will see that. And a female with a lot of reptilian in her would smile back if she liked a male. That's how you do it, is the teeth. Okay, recent happenings. Okay, the birthday card. Went to a shop called Card Factory, dated, that's February, so it was late January, to buy some discounted wrapping paper. Standing in the middle of the shop, looked round, and there was a birthday card, of course, with my picture on it. And I said to my wife, why is my picture on a birthday card? And she said, what? I said, why the F-U-C-K is my picture on a birthday card? So she looks at it and says, oh my God, I'm so shocked. I buy this card and I just walk straight home. This is 3 o'clock in the afternoon. At 6 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm still sitting in this card, looking at this card. And I think, this isn't right. I need to see my solicitor. So I went down to the solicitor and said, I don't have any recollection of this. This is my picture on a birthday card. Where the hell's this come from? So I had a chat with Wynne Keach, and between the three of us, we decided it was best to approach the card company themselves. And he said, you've got to go and buy their entire stock out immediately. So I went in thinking, oh my God, it's £1.39 a card. Supposing they've got thousands of them. So I said, how many of these have you got? Oh, hang on, I'll go into the storehouse. Oh God. Seven. And I think, they've sold them all. So I quickly bought the seven. And I phoned the card factory. The managing director, really lovely man, good as his word, phoned me back. And he said, I need to tell you that we followed the law precisely. We bought this image from another company called Paper House. I'll give you the phone number for the managing director. Phoned the managing director. Pass it round. In this, there's a picture of me, because you might think, well, how do I know that's you? That's taken a while back. But inside is a picture of me at the same time, and you can see. The managing director of Paper House, same thing. I followed the law. I bought this from a company called Photo Library. You're going to have a problem. They're in America. Fine. Emailed them, very unhelpful, and said, well, how do you prove that's you in there? So I said, well, I'll tell you what. I've got lots of election posters around that time. I know when that was. I remember the shirt. I remember the tie. And I've got round glasses on. I know what year that is. So I sent him all my Labour Party leaflets and posters. And he said, oh, right, okay, I've got to take you seriously now. He said, the test question is, when was that photograph taken? He said, if you say you are who you are, you'll know from the clothing. And I said, I'll tell you, that's 1997. And he said, ah, good enough, it's 1996. Right, I'll have to investigate this. Goes and investigates it and says, actually, it can't be you. It was taken in America. It was taken in Texas. And the photographer is a Jewish gentleman living in Texas. So I said, well, are you telling me then that's not me in the picture? Oh, no, Mr. Parks. I'm not saying that's not you in the picture. All I'm saying is the name I've got for that gentleman is not your name. Okay, what are you going to do about it? Nothing, because English law doesn't touch us. End of conversation. Right, so I thought, I'm not having this. I'm going to go to the press. So I went to the newspapers for the whole purpose of getting the press to contact this company and put the heat on. And John Stoker, who is the editor of Whitby Gazette, phoned me and said, we've been in touch. All they're giving us is no comment. And he said, look, I've been a newsman for many years. We've researched you. We know you're genuine. He said, when someone keeps saying no comment, he said, I know who I prefer to believe. If you want this to go national, I can make that happen for you. And I said, no, because there's Security Service Association with this. And he said, yeah, I probably agree with you. But if you change your mind, let me know. However, I went back to the card factory and said, I want these cards pulled. I've not agreed to them. And, you know, you could have at least given me some royalties on it. Or the number you've sold, no money from it. Let's be very human about it and greedy, shall we? So he says, well, we've pulled it anyway. But that's not because you've complained. Oh, right. He said, we've pulled it because it's a test run. We wanted to see how well it sold. So I said, okay, how many have you sold? How many did you print, rather? Seven. I said, you printed seven? I said, I've bought seven. And he said, yeah, you've bought our entire stock. I said, and where did you sell these cards to test out how well they sold? Oh, he said, in your branch, in Whitby, where you live. I said, you printed seven cards and you put them in the store where I live. He said, it's a small world, isn't it? And that was the end of our conversation. I wish, if I had my time again, that when I stood in that store, I'd done this, because there would have been somebody putting those cards in the carousel behind me. Or if I'd done that, I'd have seen your archetypal man in black with the old hat walking out that way. Okay, so there's evidence for you. If you want evidence, there it is. Okay, and there's the card for those of you who haven't yet got round to it. Who the hell would buy a birthday card that said that on it? So clearly I'm in a car, somebody was next to me who's been photoshopped out, and a great big bear placed next to me. And only seven of these were made. Okay, let's move on. How are we for time, Joanne? Oh, okay, I'll rush through it. Okay, car incident. I put a, I'm going to choose my words very carefully now. I put a call out. I've got a lot of time for David Icke, actually. He's a gentleman that I would really love to meet, David Icke. And I put a call out on his website saying, has anybody seen the reptiles? And I got lots of calls back. One of them stood out as extremely genuine. And I followed this up, and this young woman came over to Britain. Her father, a prominent Mason in another country, a millionaire, a governor of a large city. And we had a three-way meeting with Wim Keach. And driving back from that meeting, my car was rammed, not an accident, 65 miles an hour, car coming straight up on the left, rammed straight into me. Because I'm a driving instructor for trade, I was able to control the car. My car was worth £6,000. The damage to it was £10,000. The guy who crashed into me, his car was completely and utterly destroyed. There was only one wheel left on his car. Our car was airborne. We turned left. We crashed on our side. I was knocked unconscious for a few seconds. We couldn't get out. Okay, for those of you who understand this stuff, you may not be surprised to learn that within seconds of the car crash, we were rescued from the car by off-duty soldiers, an off-duty doctor and an off-duty nurse who pulled us out from that vehicle. The guy got straight out of the car and admitted it, and his exact words to me were, I didn't mean to crash into you. I'm really sorry. I had no choice because of the stuff up ahead. And that's what he said to me. But I thought about it afterwards. Did he actually say to me, I'm sorry I crashed into you. I didn't mean to. I had no choice because of the stuff in my head. The car that crashed into me was a company car. The logo on the car was ICU. And if you Google it, it belongs to an American company called ICU Incorporated, who specialize in sweeping for electronic bugs, following people, and checking up on people. And that was the vehicle that crashed into us. Fortunately, there was a lorry driver behind who saw everything, reported it to the police, so I obviously taken him to court, and I've got compensation and the rest of it. Whoever it was didn't like the fact that the three of us had got together, and it was not aliens that did that. It was human agency. And when this young woman went back to tell her dad, his first words were, Satan cabal. Satan cabal. It was a human agency. Okay, we're going to rush through now. Lightning stop, because originally my talk was going to be a bit longer, but cut down. On the left is me being taken by a creature I call Mum. On the right-hand side is a mantid control ship. This is the lower deck of a mantid control ship. and you can see that there are groups of mantids sitting on chairs. I don't know how these chairs, they float. There's no bars or legs holding these chairs up, they just hover. And the guys sitting on the chairs operate all the controls in this section here. The guys standing up, 1, 2, 3, they operate all the controls here. These two guys here operate everything in that section. And what they're doing, they're not flying the ship, they are coordinating human timelines, abductions, contacts. You have no idea the project management that is required for these guys to come down and see you at 35 milliseconds past 2 o'clock in the afternoon of a Friday. The work that is needed, because then they might be in Japan 20 minutes later and then back to America. So this information goes, I've tried to show, there's no sharp corners on these craft. It's curves like that. So the information that they coordinate goes up, and this is the level above them. These guys here are receiving the information which has come from down there. These guys are piloting the ship, and they have viewing screens, and they're piloting. But I've tried to show the flowing lines here, the power supply that makes this craft fly. It's absolutely vital that the craft can convey this energy round the outside of the ship. It's that shape. And that's the commander's chair and the lifting device that takes him up and down different floors. Technologies, you like this, I hope. You put your hand over what appears to be a solid piece of metal, a shape appears, it lifts up, floats up like that, and this device here allows the commander to observe the power plant. So diamonds, triangles, squares, oblongs, all move across here passing information, so you don't have to go and do a diagnostic of your power plant. That does it all, and then you just hold it out and it drops straight back into the metal. It's a morphing metal. Nitinol metal that you can read about is just pathetic. This is real stuff. Again, here, hand over the console. Two discs come up. I don't know whether you look into this and it imprints information, or whether when you put that in the console, the information is imprinted. I'm going to rush through because we're running out of time. Transportation in tubes. You stand on a little disc and it flies you up. The little greys don't travel on those. They have little trains. Literally, like, think of a mine shaft where you see all the trains, but they run on a monorail. And the greys will sit in that, and the, you know, if you like, the underground bases, those that are left. Okay, I saw this on a ship where a specimen got free, a bird. These things are really tall and it's comical. It's like Treebeard waving its arms to catch it. They go and get a device. And somehow this device is not like a fan. It just draws, the bird's not hurt at all. It draws the bird down and then they capture the specimen, and that gives you some idea of how they capture them on Earth. Fascinating. Underground tour of a base. I was taken and shown humans naked walking past a great bank of crystals. And this device here, which I couldn't look at, is even when I tried to draw this and I just couldn't. As the humans walk past, their bodies are, I don't know, scanned by this crystal. It does something to them. And then the readings are given off here. The humans then come out of a tunnel and they're met by this guy who appears to have a medieval helmet on his head. And he's really tall and muscular. And these are first-time humans. This is the very first time they've ever been here. And they've been scanned. They've obviously passed through the test and they're then being met. Okay, then Mum says, let me take you on a tour. And I see we're underground, rough hewn brick walls with tanks. And then these two are tall greys. God knows why that one's upside down. And I say, look, that one's upside down. Doesn't answer me, just says, come and see along here. So we've got greys here and humans stored here on the right-hand side. So three sections, 1, 2, 3. We travel on the disc. We look at them. And I get lonely, so I seek out his hand, because that's the close relationship I have. And then I point out things that interest me. And we look and we just look at them and he shows me them. Okay. On the left-hand side from Mary Rodwell's book, Awakening, drawn by Jane Milligan Melchior, is a lion being. And on the right-hand side, a lion being that I was shown on a viewing screen. Cat people are often shown with the big ears. That's what they project into your mind. The reality is their ears are just offset here. I'm not too displeased with that drawing. I think the head is more domed than nine. And here he makes the sign of the pyramid and the Eye of Horus, because these beings had a great responsibility in building the Giza pyramid. The cat queen, she visits me regularly. Those aren't her real ears, that's just a cap she wears. She has a seal of office and a black cape. This is a female. This is her attendant and bodyguard. I'm going to rush through. Freezing time, Chantel mentioned. That's my wife. Goes into very slow motion, and you heard it from Chantel first. Her exact words were, time stopped still, time was frozen. And my wife just goes absolutely into slow motion. And this creature flies in and spins in the air like that. And that is not how they look. This is this being's projection into my mind. I'm a cat being. You're going to see me as a cat because that's how you expect to see me. And you like cats, so you're like me. Dishwasher, I haven't even got time to talk about missing time now. We're running out of time. Please don't get confused. Super special human soldiers are not super soldiers. Super soldiers are generally very fit humans who have implants, have genetic alteration to them, and are sometimes coached or schooled by extraterrestrials. These are humans who are taken by extraterrestrials to do a fighting job. And they have weapons because they're going to fight other humanoids. That's why they're given weapons. I had the very great pleasure of meeting somebody who was one of these. And I drew this gun and I said, I've got a real problem with this because I can't see a trigger. And I'm not going to lie and put a trigger in. I just don't know where the trigger is. And this should be a sight because traditionally that's where humans mount sights on rifles. But it isn't. It's a power pack. And he said, oh yeah. He said, when it's full power, it's green. It's a traffic light system. Yellow, amber, red, low power. And he said, there isn't a trigger as such. You just squeeze here and the gun fires. And they wear almost like bicycle, motorbike helmets, and a tube goes down the throat. I won't have time to explain that now. Tall grey. This one came to visit me. Beautiful blue eyes. Blue deliberately because blue is a very soporific effect on a human. You know, why do you think police cars have blue lights? Why do ambulances have blue lights? Blue is a colour that humans, when the reptilians were altering our human genetics, blue was a special colour to calm you down or to make you have respect. So he came to visit me and he says, you have no fear of me, because he's used to people screaming and hitting him and shouting. And I say, I have no fear of any of you. You have a very gentle face and lovely blue eyes. We're already friends. At which point he leans forward so I can stroke his face. And he says, it is as I was told about you. Are they mine? Walking along, mantid, two hybrid children. And I think to myself, oh, that was me when I was little. I used to hold mantid's hand. I still do. And we stop and we look. And I've been shown them. I was shown them for a reason. 5 minutes? Sure. You can stop if you want. Okay. Storyboard fashion, okay, on a mantid ship. I put my hand on the left shoulder of a mantid. The reptilians chip with agreement. The mantids carry a chip in all their left shoulders. It's with agreement. And as a human in their world, you can interface with the computers by touching the shoulder if you are so, because you can feel the information through. And I say it's busy today, meaning downstairs on Earth. Downstairs, that's what we call it. Down on Earth, it's busy today. There's a lot going on. And he says, yes, there's a lot in progress. Okay, and I say, if I was in our family body, I haven't even discussed that. If I was in our family body, I could command here. I would get bored. Because he says, would you like to? No, I'd get bored being in one place too long. Well, in our family body, I wouldn't. I know that. But I wouldn't want to command up here for too long. And he always calls me the Adam. And he says, the Adam was not meant to be off the Earth for long periods. And I say, when will my task be concluded or finished? And he says, I cannot say. I say, I wish to move on. And he says, you agreed to do what you agreed to do. And I say, well, I do not go back on that agreement, but neither do I wish to stay on the earth forever. When my task is over, I wish to ascend. And he says, very unhelpfully, the usual stock answer there. And then I get very cross and I call up a picture. You can mentally call up pictures on viewing screens when you're in their world. I pull up a picture of the earth and I say, you know how hard it is. You've been there. All the humans, I'm sorry, all the pain, the filth, the poverty, the violence, the lies. It's so hard, so hard, so hard. And then here I sort of go really mad. And I say, I call out to the stars. I'm so furious of it all. And then I say, yet I know that the humans can evolve. They can change into the most wonderful and fantastic creation in the multiverse. And that must be seen through. And he says, you're a part of that. And I say, well, I am a part of the new beginning for the earth. And that was mentioned today. Somebody mentioned the new earth. I'm a part of the new beginning. And he says, yes, that is as it should be. And I then have an in-joke. It's not an in-joke, it's an in-argument. And I say, okay, my body, well, our bodies, but your souls. And he says, no, our bodies and our souls. And I say, okay, my people or our people, your people, for without you, there would be no vehicles for our souls. And then straight off the wall, I say, you don't show me enough love. I'm lonely. To which he becomes terribly confused. They don't understand our human brain at all. I realize this confusion and I say, he says, how can this be? We visit you on a regular basis so that you'll never feel alone and you're always reminded of your family. And I say, you're confused. I've confused you. I'll be strong for both of us. And he says, you will. Now for something completely different. Didn't Wynne put something completely different? Who knows what that is? Because it could be different shapes. That's what this person saw. I didn't draw this. This was drawn by somebody who sees jinn. This is what she saw, this woman who was in the car with me that was crashed. This is the being that often visits her. It's a jinn, in Eastern religion, very well known. About that big. Okay, end of talk. Sorry. Any questions? What I'd like you to do, if you have any views, questions or comments, that's my email address. I'm very happy to take any emails from you. Can we squeeze in just 1 or 2 minutes of questions if there are any?
Sure,
not a problem.
We want to hear everything. I'm just...
Of course.